and it's my real distinct pleasure to welcome you all here for a very special event this afternoon. We are doing this in partnership with the Asia Society, and within the Seeger Center, we have launched a program last year called the India Initiative, which is our effort to promote greater attention on Indo-US relations, on Indian studies across the board. And so this is part of our partnership that we have had for the last several months now between Asia Society and the India Initiative here. There's some more material in the back about the India Initiative, and I'd welcome you, I'd ask, urge you to become a member and supporter of this, what we think is one of our major efforts in the coming years. Well, today's event, we've had a number of events that are very, that we've had a huge outpouring of audiences for, and from what we had today also, we had over 100 people sign up. We were thinking of calling it a day after a point, but then we let people keep coming in. I think you'll see more and more people joining us as the afternoon goes on. We've done things on music, on politics, international affairs, business, and today we're turning to literature. And I can't think of two more enormously qualified authors for us to be featuring this afternoon. Now, you know, most of us are familiar, of course, with the huge explosion in the so-called post-colonial literature that is that we've seen in the last so many years, where English is being used as a vehicle by writers from non-European, non-Western worlds. And of course, I think the high point of it was The Remains of the Day by Ishiguro, a quintessential post-colonial writer. When we talk about India, we can look at writers in a number of different ways, and I certainly will not try to pigeonhole these two talented writers into any particular category, but you know, you may have heard of India, writers living in India, writing in English, Indians born outside of, born in India, but living outside of India and writing in English, the Indian diaspora writers, and so forth. So there are lots of different ways in which the field of English literature is trying to understand this emergence of new literature. But as I said, I wouldn't dare try to categorize or try to identify these two, who all I can say is that they, I'm sure, have their own very special category all of their own. So without further ado, let me please ask Alka Khanna from Asia Society, who will introduce our authors for the afternoon. Thank you again for coming.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Deepa. My sincere thanks to the Seeger Center of Asian Studies, and in particular to Deepa Olapalli and Erin Robinson for helping us put together yet another wonderful event as part of our partnership, the Global India Series. As Deepa mentioned, Asia Society is a membership organization. I see many Asia Society members here this afternoon, and I want to say a special welcome and thank you to you for your support. And for the others, I encourage you to pick up a brochure from the back of the room and consider joining us. We would love to have you. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce to you our speakers for this afternoon. First of all, Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni. Chitra is an award-winning author and poet. She was born in India. She lived there until 1976, at which point she left Calcutta and came to the United States. Here she continued her education in the field of English. She received a master's degree from Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, and after that a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Her themes in writing include women, immigration, the South Asian experience, history, myth, magic, and celebrating diversity. She writes both for adults and for children, and she has been published in countless magazines. You may have seen her work in The Atlantic Monthly and The New Yorker, to name a few. Her writings have been included in over 50 anthologies and translated into 20 different languages, including Dutch, Hebrew, and Japanese. Two of her books, Mistress of Spices and Sister of My Heart, have also been made into movies by filmmakers Gurinder Chadda and Paul Burgess, and Suhasini Maniratnam, who made a Tamil TV serial based on her writings. Her short stories, Arranged Marriage, won an American Book Award. Currently, she teaches creative writing at the University of Houston, and she also serves on boards in other areas. She's on the board of two organizations that help South Asian women in abusive or domestic violence situations. She's also on the board of Pratham, an organization that helps educate children, especially those living in the urban areas of India. Chitra has judged several prestigious awards, such as the National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni. Our other distinguished guest this afternoon is Manil Suri. Manil was born and raised in what was known then as Bombay, now Mumbai, in India. He came to the United States as a student when he was 20. His first published fiction in English was The Seven Circles, a short story that appeared in The New Yorker in the year 2000. His first novel, The Death of Vishnu, debuted in 2001. Subsequently, The Death of Vishnu has been translated into 22 foreign languages. Manil was named by Time magazine as a person to watch in 2000, and he received a Guggenheim Fellowship for Fiction in 2004. Now, what some of you may not realize is that in addition to being a writer, Manil is also a mathematician. His initial academic training was in mathematics. He obtained a PhD in applied mathematics from Carnegie Mellon University, and he is a tenured full professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He still does mathematical research in the field of numerical analysis, and in addition, he has been spending time thinking up of ways in which to bring mathematics to the public at large. He believes that people can go to museums to access art. Why can't they have as easy a way of accessing mathematics? And one of his attempts at popularizing mathematics has been the presentation Taming Infinity, which he actually presented in the year 2006 at the International Literature Festival in Berlin. You can learn about these pursuits of his through his academic website. Today, however, we are here to listen to him about his writing fiction. He has a couple of other talents. He's interested in art. The cover design of his book, The Death of Vishnu, was inspired by his own painting of a Bollywood-style poster. He also loves cooking and has written about cooking and has cooked extensively. He's a man of many talents, and to see one of his latest expressions of talent, I urge you to look him up on YouTube, where you will see something which you would never imagine. That's all I'll say. Please welcome Manil Suri. We've built today as an event called Authors in Conversation, and that's just what it's going to be. Both Chitra and Manil will read excerpts from their novels and talk to each other and to us about common themes in writing, in particular focusing on the role of the Indian epic and mythology in modern fiction. And after that, they will be happy to take questions and answers. And at the end, they'll be available to sign copies of their books. Their books are available for sale here in the room. If you'd like to purchase one, please do so at the end of the session. Thank you. It's all yours. It's a great pleasure to be here. And thanks to Deepa and to Alka for inviting me to speak. And it's a special pleasure to do an event with Manil. We've done a couple of events together before. And it's always very nice to see him again. So I'll start by talking a little bit about how I came to write The Palace of Illusions. And this really goes way back into my childhood to a time when I had no idea I was going to be a writer. But my grandfather was a great storyteller, and I would go spend my school vacations with him. Now, I grew up in the city of Kolkata, but he lived out in the country, and I would go out to his house in the country. And this was really in a little village where there was no running water, there was no electricity, and I just loved it. I loved going from Kolkata to this place, which seemed to me to be a whole other world of adventure. One of the things that made it so pleasant is that my grandfather, in the evenings, he would gather all of us cousins together, and he would light a little kerosene lamp, and he would start telling us these stories out of our culture, stories from the Bengali folk tales and stories from the epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And I think my love for the epic and my love for these stories that come to us, that are translated through the voice of people that we love and come to us, you know, centuries down the road. My love for that started then. And I think, although I didn't articulate it, my belief that the epic or the stories out of our myths are really very valid, very timely, and very, in some ways, contemporary to what we are, our experiences living in the 21st century, that belief, I think, took its root in me at that time. But I remember thinking that in the epics, and I love the story of the Mahabharata, which, as many of you know, is the story of two princely families, the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who are related, who are cousins. And the Kauravas take away the Pandava kingdom through trickery, and the rest of the Mahabharata is how the Pandavas, what they have to do before they can get back their kingdom. And the Mahabharata ends in this huge and devastating war. So I was interested in the Mahabharata for two particular reasons. One is that it is probably one of the earliest and most powerful pictures of the devastation that war can bring. And there's a very strong message in the Mahabharata that obviously over 5,000 years we have not taken to heart, is that war is something where everyone loses. No matter what the reason for war is, the cost of war is huge and everyone ends up losing. And I felt that this was an important time in our history as a nation and as a world community to think of that message. The other thing that fascinated me about the Mahabharata is the story of the women in the Mahabharata. As with most epics, the Mahabharata focuses on the public story, the public action. It focuses on heroic adventures, it focuses on the battles and the great weapons and the heroes, and they're all male. However, the Mahabharata, like the other great epics, has fascinating women characters who do affect the story, but they're not in the center of the action. They're kind of off to the margins. And we rarely get to hear of what these women are thinking or how they're feeling as these great events are unfolding against their lives, you know, they're affecting their lives. So I thought many years back, again, before I thought I would ever be a writer, that it would be wonderful if I could ever write the story of one of these women, putting them in the center of a book. And that is what I've done in The Palace of Illusions. I've retold the story from the point of view of Draupadi. Many of you know she has a unique claim to fame, among many other things that she's famous for. She is married to the five Pandava brothers all at the same time. And that makes her unique. And people in India, I mean, she's still like someone people think about a lot, and she often comes up in conversations for this reason. She's also, in her own right, just a fascinating and very complex character. So The Palace of Illusions is the story of Draupadi. She's called Panchali, which is another one of her names in this novel. And the book begins with her birth and ends in her death. And throughout, it's her vision of the world of the Mahabharata. And I thought that that is what I really wanted to do, put the life of a woman in the center of the story. First of all, to show people how the narrative viewpoint completely changes the meaning of a story. Because although I've kept just about every public event that's in the Mahabharata that I've referred to, they're all the same. But I think the private events, what she's thinking, what she's feeling, what she says in the solitude or the intimate spaces of her bedroom, those are the ones that I have imagined, and those are the ones that I want especially to share with all of you. Manil and I decided that we would each read something, and then we'll discuss some more, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. So I'm going to read one small section, which is, I think, one of the most fascinating and dramatic moments of the Mahabharata. This is when Draupadi is about to get married. So Draupadi, or Panchali as she's called here, she is going to have a Swayamvar, which means, as many of you know, all of the major kings of the whole continent, and at that time India went extended way beyond what modern India is now, or even modern India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, it went way beyond, over the mountains. And people came from everywhere to be at this wedding ceremony where she would choose a husband. Now, when Panchali hears that she's going to have a Swayamvar, at first she's very excited, because Panchali, at her birth, there was a prophecy that she would change the course of history. And she's been thinking as she's been growing up, how am I going to change the course of history? Because her life until now has been very sheltered within the four walls of her palace. But she says, well, now I'm going to be able to choose a husband, and I can actually have some agency and ownership in my life. But as she finds out, it is not that simple. She's not actually going to choose a husband. There is a test, an archery test, a very complex archery test that I won't go into. And whoever wins, that's the person she's going to have to marry. Okay. Well, at first she's not happy about it, because it's not really a Swayamvar. But then she's okay, because she's been told by her brother, Dhri, Drishtadyumna, whom she calls Dhri for short, that Aunt Krishna, who is a family friend, that the person who is the only person who can win is one of the Pandava brothers, a great hero, Arjun, the greatest archer of that time. So she's like, okay, I think that won't be so bad. I can marry Arjun. All right, now just before the Swayamvar, though, there's a problem, which is that a report comes that all the five Pandava brothers have been killed in a fire that was set to the house in which they lived. So all of a sudden now Panchali is like, well, who is going to win? This is such a difficult test, probably no one else can win. And then her brother tells her, there is one other person, but we don't want you to marry him because he's very unsuitable. He's allied to the Kauravas, and his name is Karna. And he is, as you know, a mystery character. So I'm going to read from this part where she knows all of this information and she's about to come into the Swayamvar Hall. Coiled on the silver tray like a white snake, the wedding garland was as thick as my forearm. I regarded it warily, as though it might, at any moment, decide to strike. What's wrong now? Dhaima said. Okay. Short break. Dhaima is one of the characters I created. She's the nursemaid who brings up Panchali, because Panchali was born out of a fire and therefore has no mother. She needs someone to bring her up, so I thought, we have to have a character. What's wrong now? Dhaima said. Why is your face like a blackened pot? Okay. And here I was thinking in Bengali, and if there are Bengali people in the audience, you know the expression kalo hani, which you can't really translate, but I did my best. All right. Why is your face like a blackened pot? It's too heavy, I said. I imagined placing it around a neck. I could clearly see the corded, straining muscles, though the rest of the face was frustratingly blank. Ridiculous, Thaima said. If he's a true hero, he'll be able to bear its weight. And yours too, she added with a wink. Attendants buzzed around me. A little more lotus pollen to burnish the bride's cheeks. The end of the wedding sari, white and gold, arranged cleverly to accentuate the swell of her breast while creating a virginal effect. An old woman rubbed paste of sandalwood on my navel with a sly smile. Bangles, waistband, anklets, a jeweled nose ring so massive it had to be held up by a chain attached to my hairdo. I feel like I'm in battle armor, I told Haima. You are, she said. I'm going to skip over the next part where her brother takes her to the hall, and when he goes to the hall, he is pointing out all of the suitors, all the kings in the various countries they've come from, and he also points out to her that they've all brought their armies, and the armies are outside. And this is a very dangerous and volatile situation, because if no one wins, there's going to be like a riot, and they'll say that they were brought here and shamed. So, you know, she's getting kind of nervous here. And after he's pointed everyone out, she asks, where's Arjun? Not here, he said. I marveled at how he'd learned to make his voice expressionless. He went on to name other names. When he stopped, I asked, is that all? He understood the question beneath the question. His eyes showed his displeasure. Karna has come. Dri didn't point him out, but I saw him because I'd seen his portrait before. Next to Duryodhan, half hidden behind a marble pillar. My heart beat so hard, I was sure Dri would hear. I longed to look into Karna's face, to see if those eyes were indeed as sad as the artist had portrayed, but even I knew how improper that would be. I focused instead on his hands, the wrists disdainfully bare of ornaments, the powerful, battered knuckles. If my brother had known how badly I wanted to touch them, he would have been furious. Duryodhan made a comment, probably about me, and his companions slapped their knees and guffawed. Karna alone, I noted with gratitude, sat still as a flame. Only the slightest thinning of his lips indicated his disapproval, but it was enough to silence Duryodhan. Dri was calling me to the dais, his voice so sharp that my attendants stared in surprise. I went, but all the way, loyalty and desire dueled inside me. If Arjun wasn't here, what right did Krishna and Dri have to insist that I not choose Karna? A trumpet sounded. The contest had begun. And I'm going to stop here and turn it over to Manil. But as those who know the story know that this is going to be an important scene where Panchali will be forced to insult Karna, even though she doesn't really want to, in order to stop something more terrible from happening. And by the end of this whole action, she will be married not only to Arjun, but all the 5 Pandava brothers who are here in disguise. More later.
Well, this is wonderful to have such a big audience during lunchtime. I don't work in the city, so now I know what people do here. I managed to go to these things at lunch. So it's really wonderful being here. Thank you for the invitation. And you know, Chitra and I, this is our 3rd event together. So. This is getting to be really fun. It's very interesting. We were talking a little bit about, you know, our notes on the epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana in particular. And when Chitra talked about how she grew up with all these stories and so on, I realized that I didn't. There were growing up in India, you can't help but be exposed to these stories. So as a kid, I did see the Ramayana. There was a film for children made on it. And you did hear things from the Mahabharata, even though they might not have been specified as being from them. But these things sort of get absorbed into you. And I didn't pay much attention to all of this. When I started writing The Death of Vishnu, my first book, it was supposed to be a short story, and it was inspired by this man named Vishnu who lived in our building and who died in our building. And just the fact that his name was Vishnu and that I started writing a short story sort of led me along a path that I didn't expect. I was taking a writing course, and the instructor said, you know, if you have a character named Vishnu, you need to connect him with the god Vishnu. because that's what people will expect. It's too loaded a term to put as the title of your story. And so that's when I really started looking into the mythological aspects of Vishnu, started looking into his mythology, started looking into the fact that, you know, he has incarnations like Ram and Krishna, who are in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, respectively. And that's what really led me to read the Bhagavad Gita, which is in some sense a part of the Mahabharata, and really look at a lot of the stories that come out of them. So it was more accidental for me, but once I started looking into it, I realized that, yes, some of these things were familiar, and that this was a very interesting world. And I was really struck by how these epics kind of combine so many different things. I mean, they're sort of like India, where, you know, when you go to India, it's very hard to concentrate on just one thing. You're just bombarded from all sides with Bollywood and caste and class and religion and, you know, everything. It's just a complete funhouse, a madhouse. And that's the kind of structure that these epics have. Because if you look at them, they really combine not just the religious myths, not just the kind of war aspect that that Chitra was saying, but it also has a great deal of social discourse, like the position of women that we're going to talk about a little later, the fact that these epics really, in some sense, chronicle the wars that were actually fought in India, where, you know, the Aryan culture sort of tried to subjugate the Dravidian culture. That's sort of the basis of the Ramayana. And so there's a whole bunch of things going on under the surface. And that's the kind of spirit I think we as Indian authors like to either consciously or subconsciously put into our books. I mean, that's the kind of culture I think we are brought up in. It was also very interesting to hear what Chitra just talked about, the nice episode of Draupadi and Arjun. The story, as she said, is that she ends up being married to all of the Pandava brothers. And the way that happens is that when they come home, Arjun has won Draupadi, he's won this contest, and they call out, they tell their mother who's inside that, you know, Arjun has just won this, and she says, well, you must share whatever you got with all of your brothers. And that's how, you know, once she says that, it can't be taken back, because you know, once something is said, you can't take it back, and so they have to follow their mother's rule. And so when we started talking about what passages we would read out, we are each going to read two little passages, and what I'm going to do is actually read out something that was in the first book, The Death of Vishnu, just because it really corresponds so nicely with what Chitra just said. I didn't have the story of Draupadi in here, but what I did instead was I took that, I sort of abstracted that, and made Draupadi a Draupadi-like character, which is actually going to be a bird, as you will see. There's an interesting thing throughout the book where Vishnu's mother, as he's dying, you know, he keeps thinking back to his mother, all the stories she told him about reincarnation. And there's a sort of spirit named Jeev that goes through the book and is reincarnated in many ways. And this is one of Jeev's incarnations. So I'm just going to read you this section. Let me tell you, my little Vishnu, of a yogi spirit named Jeev. A yogi spirit named Jeev, born 990,000 times. Many, many centuries ago, during the days that the Pandavas and the Kauravas were living the Mahabharata, Jeev had just risen from being an insect. Sometimes he would be born a bird, and a few times even a small animal. Brahma had awoken from his sleep and breathed out the universe only recently. The air was still new. The streams had cool, clear water. There were enchanted forests in the land, and even the trees had spirits living in them. The lives Jeev led were easy ones. He hopped and flew and ran, using the tiny quantities of pure air and water that he needed for his existence. He went through many deaths and rebirths, it is true, but when one is so small, it is not too painful to be born again. It was during one of his lifetimes as a bird that Jeev found himself being carried to the Pandava's house. He had been about to alight in a tree when an arrow came flying through the leaves and grazed his skin. A puff of feathers flew into the air, the sight of which caused him to fall to the ground in shock. "Open your eyes, little sparrow," a voice said, and G found himself cradled in a palm. "The arrow was meant not for you. I was practicing hitting that branch without looking, and you had not appeared when I put on the blindfold." The voice belonged to Arjun, the greatest archer who ever lived. Jeev saw Arjun's handsome face, saw the rippling chest made strong by archery, and felt a surge in his little feathered breast. "Such a pretty bird you are," Arjun said, stroking Jeev's beak. "Come, I will take you home. You can stay with us till you feel better." Arjun wrapped Jeev in a handkerchief and tucked him into his vest. As they made their way home, Jeev lost himself in the scent of Arjun's body. Even in the time it took to be carried to the Pandava's hut, Jeev found himself helplessly knelt. They reached the hut and Arjun called out, "Look, mother, come and see what I've found." His mother answered from inside, "Whatever it is, you must share with your brothers." Being a Rajput, Arjun was bound by his mother's words, words that once spoken could not be retracted. So it was that Jeev became a mascot for all five of the Pandava brothers. They took care of him day by day in turn, feeding him from their palms, letting him alight on their shoulders, petting his tiny head with a finger. And when they traveled, they took him along wherever they went, carrying him in a golden cage when his wings could not flap fast enough to keep up. At first, Jeev tried to live with this arrangement, but he was not happy. He wanted to eat only from Arjun's palm, nestle only against his body, sing only in his ear. He lived for that fifth day in every cycle, when everything felt and smelled and looked perfect, when he was with the only brother out of the five he truly cared for. Eventually, Jeev could not hide his feelings. He started becoming ill-tempered the 4 days he was not with Arjun. He refused to eat anything and pecked at fingers if Arjun's brothers tried to stroke him. His greatest ire was reserved for Arjun's mother, whose directive had been a curse for him and could never be taken back. He began leaving droppings on her bed and pecking at her head while she was asleep. The brothers tried mollifying Jeev, but the rage he felt would not be controlled. The day came when Arjun put Jeev in his cage and started out for the forest. They journeyed for many hours, past unfamiliar trees and streams. As they traveled, Jeev kept his eyes on Arjun's face and tried to understand the sadness in it. They reached a clearing, and Arjun opened the door of the cage. Jeev hopped onto the finger Arjun offered and felt himself buoyed through the air. "Each creature has its own karma to follow, little sparrow," Arjun said, and kissed him lightly on the side of his head. "Today, it is time for you to find yours." For a moment, Jeev saw the face he loved so much right next to his, gazed at the mouth, the lips that had just pressed into his feathers. Then it all disappeared in a blur as Arjun whisked his finger into the air. Despite himself, Jeev found his feet letting go of their perch, found his wings unfurling, found the muscles in his breast begin to pump. He found himself rising, rising about Arjun, rising above the plants and the trees, rising above the forest, until he could look down and see a sea of green, and in the distance, rivers cutting through, and further beyond the mountains, and beyond them even the Trinity, with Brahma reclining in the chariot of the seven swans, and Vishnu rising in all his brilliance into the sky, and Shiva at the edge of the world, getting ready to do his dance. So we'll start talking now.
Okay. Well,
but maybe yes. We should open it for some questions.
Sure, absolutely.
If we have time, we have another passage each to read. But I know that you really want to ask us some questions. Hopefully some easy questions to which we will be able to provide brilliant answers.
And Yeah, and one of the things we thought that to make it more like a conversation, it would be nice to have questions that are addressed, that we can both answer, that we can each answer, rather than just do one. So if you can phrase your questions in that way.
And there's a microphone that one of our helpers is going to bring around. Please identify yourselves and tell us where you're from, your affiliation, before you ask the question. Thank you.
And I notice a couple of empty chairs in front, so if people in the back would like to come forward, you are most welcome to come and fill these chairs. I know that this spot near the door is the strategic one for easy exit. However, there are seats.
Sujit Mansingh, American University. Both of you have spoken about autophagy. I lean to Malika Sarabhai's view that Draupadi is really the central character of the Mahabharata war. Without Draupadi, there wouldn't have been a war at all. It was she who caused the war. And then, at the end, of course, when all her children had been killed, she laments. It is Draupadi's lament that brings out so powerfully the lose-lose results of war. So I'm intrigued that both of you have suggested that she's a marginal character. I've always thought of her as the central character.
That's a good question. And I'll go first. The thing is that she is very important, right? But when you read the Mahabharata, you see that there are many other things that are involved in the war that is caused. And in fact, the war would not have happened if there were many times that the Pandavas approached the Kauravas and actually said, look, let's not have this war, let's try to solve this problem in some other way. And each time, Duryodhan, the Kaurava prince, said no, he would not do it. And emissaries were sent to him. So at any point, the war could have been averted if Duryodhan had not said things like, I'm not even going to, they asked at the end, just before the war, for 5 villages. They said, you can have your kingdom, we just want 5 villages. And he said, I won't even give you the amount of earth that can be held on the point of a needle. So, you know, they were forced to go into the war. So certainly, yes, Draupadi is one of the causes for the war. And in my book, she certainly feels that she is a cause for the war because she wants revenge. And when everything goes bad at the end and her own children are killed and her own brother, whom she loves dearly from, you know, the time they were born as twins, he's killed and her father is killed and Karna is killed, she realizes the cost of war and she blames herself. But what I think I tried to show is, yes, she is one cause and she is very central. You don't have to be the cause of the war to be central. I think she's central because she's such a charismatic and complex personality. But the truth is that there are many causes and many people, Krishna will point that out to her, that many people are really responsible for the war. In fact, later there will be people who say that she was responsible, but I hope that this will be a novel where we will at least question that she's not the only one who's responsible.
So my book is really not related to the Mahabharata, but your question is very interesting just because of how it pertains to the other big epic, which is the Ramayana, which, you know, Ramayana is the story of Ram. But again, the whole Ramayana is, a lot of it is really propagated by Sita, who's Ram's wife, where Sita is abducted by Ravana, who's in Lanka, which is now Sri Lanka. And he carries her, kidnaps her, and then Ram comes and, you know, rescues her from there. And what I really found fascinating about the Ramayana was just the position of women and the position of men, too. Both these epics, in some sense, deal with the idea of perfection. Ram is someone who is bound to perform his duty. You know, there's this whole idea of dharma, that you have to perform your duty. So Ram's duty lies to his subjects. And therefore, he does things like he forces Sita to go through fire to prove her purity. And then later on, there's a kind of sequel to the Ramayana where some washerman, his wife is out all night, and he says, I'm not going to take you back. I'm not like Ram, that I'll take you back after you've been all here all night, outside all night. And so Ram is forced to banish Sita, even though she's proved her purity through this fire ritual. And she goes off into the woods and, you know, brings up their love and Kush, their sons. And at the end, Ram discovers them, and he basically says, you know, I want you back. And this is something I remember from my childhood when I used to watch this children's film on Ramayana. The ground used to open, and Sita used to fall in. And I never understood why that was, and I kept asking my mother, what happened, you know, why is that? And she always said that it was such a big insult for Sita, for the ground, that it couldn't bear this insult and swallowed Sita. You know, that Ram is, after all this, telling her to come back. And of course, there are other interpretations of that, but that's the one that really stuck with me. And so ever since then, I was really, perhaps that's the first scene that I saw how important women were in both these epics, especially the Ramayana. And perhaps that's the reason why, you know, the second book that I wrote, it really is about this woman's journey. Meera is a central character, and it's all told from her point of view. So I think that, you know, just like in Indian society, there are things that are hidden there that women, you know, depending upon how you interpret it, are either the center, even though they might not be overtly. So that's very interesting, I think, just the interpretation or possible interpretations.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something real quick to that. I think often when you look at epics, the women are seen as causes of disaster in the original tellings of the epics. And I would just like people to, you know, think about that a little bit. How much of the disaster which is ascribed to the women, Sita causes, you know, Lanka to be destroyed, Draupadi causes the Mahabharata war to happen and which destroys the whole civilization of that time. I just want people to, in this novel, I want people to think about how far is that true, or how far is that kind of a reading of the text. If you really look at the events, they don't necessarily prove that.
In the back there?
I wanted to say in our Western epics,
the same thing is true. The women are causing all the trouble. We have Eve in the garden. We have Helen at the Battle of Troy in the Iliad. I mean, it's true in our Western epics, too. It always seems to be the women who get the short end of the stick. And I've always felt also that the story of Sita is a particularly unfair one because she was coming to his rescue. She was stepping outside the circle not for her own delight, but because she was trying to come to the rescue of Ram, as I remember, because he was calling her. And she, how was she supposed to know that was Ram calling?
But again, you know, I think the way to interpret this is in some sense this idea of a perfect or idealized human being, or not a human being, but someone more than a human being. Just this whole idea of myths they always place these beings in very, very interesting situations where they are following certain axioms, certain rules of behavior that are very hard to adhere to or even to really sympathize with in some cases, like the one you're just saying, but which are perfectly logical in the sense that Ram is constrained to behave a certain way because of the strictures of dharma. And so that's why he just follows that. And it's very hard, and he loses sympathy. He lost my sympathy in many places. But he's always following that in a perfect sense. And that's what the whole Bhagavad Gita is about too. Like Krishna is telling Arjuna that he has to fight, even though they are his own relatives, it's his duty.
Well, I just wanted to add to that of course these ancient stories are wonderful ones, and I truly love the ancient stories. And they're made more complex by the fact that gods and humans are mixed together. So Ram is at once a man and a god, Krishna is at once a man and a god. And the rules that they follow and the, you know, what they have to do is sometimes different from how the other humans around them are living their lives, which makes it very complicated. I think it's not easy to come to a quick answer about Ram or about Krishna or even about Yudhishthir, who was, you know, the eldest Pandava brother who was in the Palace of Illusions. And one of the things I wanted to show is that for much of the story, Draupadi gets, Panchali gets very annoyed with Yudhishthira because he's always telling her how to behave in a virtuous manner. And here they've been sent to the forest unfairly, and she's really mad, and he's like, you know, good things will come of this, good things come of everything. And she says in a point at a point in the novel, a woman couldn't even enjoy being miserable around Yudhishthira. So I tried to show that you know, they're coming from different places, and I think that's what ultimately makes a great story.
In front here. Could you please tell us who you are and your affiliation?
Wait.
Thanks.
Hi, Nina Lal, I'm a student at the Elliott School in the master's program. I have always found the women in the epics to be essentially passive in their actions. I mean, it's been a frustration growing up kind of in the modern world and having these be your ideals, because I also, like, back when we grew up with these stories in my childhood, my mother, you know, bedtime stories. And it's always been kind of a frustration when you grow up here and you're supposed to be active and modern and proactive even. And do you find it constraining in a way because the women are also often forced to be passive in deciding their own fate?
Well, that's a complex question. I think one of the things I wanted to do in this retelling is to show how, although the external actions are not different, I mean, the same things happened to Panchali and to Kunti, her mother-in-law. I've actually shown how underneath a lot of things are going on with these women. Kunti is actually a very strong character. As many of you know, her husband dies when the children are babies. She's bringing up these three children of her own and two of her, you know, co-wives. And she's a wonderful mother to them. She's very strong. She brings them back to the Kaurava kingdom. Nobody wants them there because they're contenders for the kingdom. But she's like, I'm going to stay right here and I'm going to make sure my children get what is due. So it can be interpreted in many ways. Here's this poor widow being taken in by her brother-in-law, or she's this woman, and I've chosen that explanation. With Panchali, I already had a lot to work with because Panchali is known in the Mahabharata for making impulsive, stubborn, and angry decisions. So, you know, I had a lot to go with right there. And she is the one who calls down the great curse on the lives of the Kauravas, saying that your family is going to be destroyed completely because of what you've done to me, which, for those who may not know this story, is that they insult her in the court. They bring her to open court and try to disrobe her.
Well, that's actually a very good question, I think. And I think, especially in my second book, I was really quite obsessed with that question in really fashioning this character of Meera. Because what happens, I think, is not just that the passivity is in the epics, but you actually see it in the way women behave in India, or did behave back then, or were expected to behave. I've seen it in my own family, you know, in previous generations, where the passivity comes and goes, and it's like there's a lot of rebellion, but it's under the surface, and then there's overt rebellion too, and I see that with my own mother, where she was expected to, you know, follow certain paths. Her father, for instance, was a doctor. And she wanted to be a doctor. But he told her, oh, this was in the 40s. He told her, oh, no, you're a woman. It's too hard for women to be doctors, so you're not going to be a doctor. And so she obeyed that very passively. But then she started finding ways to rebel. And, you know, she made a lot of bad decisions because of that, because she wanted to assert herself, but not in an overt manner. And so that's the same thing that Meera does in the book, although things are all reversed, and, you know, now it's her father who's trying to educate her, and she rebels by saying she's not going to do it. But this is something that you see in India all over and over again, like, where do women stand? And the situation from the time that I looked at in this book, where it starts in the 50s, was very different, where it was a very male-dominated society, very patriarchal society. And it was very hard for women to really know
how to behave. Like, what is in their best interest? How should they react? How should they assert themselves? Now I think things are better. And so I think some of what you're finding in this country is sort of the kinds of expectations that are beginning to arise in at least the big cities in India, that women are supposed to be more assertive and they are less passive. But things are still unchanged in other parts.
One of the things I wanted to add to that is a culture like India's is so complex. As the author Arundhati Roy said once, India lives in several centuries at the same time. So depending on what kind of background someone is from, where exactly they grew up, and what the family culture is, the treatment of women could be very different. It could be from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I just want people to remember that. I mean, we've been attracted to certain stories and we want to tell them. And it is the truth as we see it, but it's not the whole truth. And art doesn't intend to give you the whole truth.
Welcome home. I just wanted to tell you I have a simplistic rationalization for the in the myths and ancient stories, whether Western or Indian, because they were all written by men. So I rationalize. It may not be that simple, but that's how I rationalize. And also, as far as male domination, I think, of course, India has been male dominated, but also there were a lot of male domination in Western culture as well. In 50s and 60s, women were supposed to do a certain way, go to certain, get married, have children, you know, go a certain way. So I think that male domination is not only unique to India, and it's still going on in India and in many other countries.
Well, I'll just say one thing about that even though myths may have come, you know, through men, but surprisingly, I find that in Indian mythology, the female goddess is the Devi, plays a very important role. She's very powerful. I mean, Kali is, you know, the goddess who can destroy everything. And one of the myths that I found over here was just about Parvati, Shiva's wife in the age of Shiva, where she gets tired of Shiva always going off and being an ascetic by himself. You know, that's what Shiva does. He's always meditating, and she's always left alone. So she really takes things into her own hands and goes off and makes this little boy out of her own body. And, you know, she uses bath water and sandalwood paste. And this little boy is so delightful that she spends all her time in his company and forgets all about Shiva. So there are this, you know, streaks of independence of the women. So I don't think they've been necessarily given short shrift in at least the myths.
Lauren, this gentleman over here, please.
Retired physician and current member of Asia Society, also docent at the Freer and Sacral Gallery, and we welcome your visits as you're listening to the great writers of Indian background. Basic questions to both writers. Were you aiming audience in Indian community, or is it must be? I know, you don't have that plan when you write book, but are you happy with the response from the other than Indian audience? Both of you, thank you.
That's a good question. Which kind of audience are we thinking of? And truly, I think you're very right when you say that I at least was not thinking of an audience, because I find that very disruptive and harmful to the whole effect, to the whole enterprise of writing, because. And I tell this to my students, you know, at the University of Houston's creative writing program, that it is better, and this is not what everyone says, so maybe I'm different in this, it is best not to think of an audience, because as soon as you start thinking of an audience, you begin to think of what an audience would like, what an audience would understand, and you start compromising the story. So it is best, only for me at least, to think of the story and to really create as powerful a story as I can, and to be true to the story and to the world of the story, you know, by doing careful research, etc. So I don't think of an audience. However, I've been very pleased by how the Palace of Illusions has been accepted here as well as in many countries, and particularly India. I have to tell you this little story. When I was about to, when I told my husband I was going to write this novel, he was actually very concerned. He said, you know, this is a sacred text, the Mahabharata, don't mess with the sacred text. And he said, you're going to offend everybody in India one way or another by writing this book. And as though to answer him, or as though in support of him, right after we had this conversation, a few days after, lightning struck our house. It was pretty serious. I mean, it broke our chimney and damaged our roof. My husband said, what did I say? Here's confirmation. I told him, no, this is like divine inspiration coming. But the book was extremely well received in India. I was really surprised. I think people really liked, I mean, I really have tried to be as faithful to the original and as respectful of the original as possible, but I think people really liked hearing Draupadi's story told in her own voice. I think there was a hunger for that, and I was just, you know, very thankful and delighted.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, that you really cannot think of the audience. And with the first book, that was easy because I was never published, so you know, I had no audience. I was just my mother, and that was enough. If I could make her keep reading, that I'd be satisfied. But with the second book, when the first one was successful, then I had all these people saying, well, I hope you're going to continue this story. I hope you're going to do this. I hope you're going to do that. And I really had swarms of people coming into my nightmares and demanding various things that I do in this book. And so part of the problem, part of the reason maybe it took me so long, was that I just had to get them out of my mind and really write the book that I wanted to write without any concern about how it would be received. And then the reception was, again, you know, I had a very similar story, not the lightning striking, but just that it was very well received in India where it came out first. And it was also well received in other countries. What does help, I find, is that what I think the one kind of thing one should worry about in terms of more than just an Indian audience is that sometimes one makes assumptions that one thinks, okay, everyone is going to know this. And so the fact that I had a US editor help me identify certain things that, you know, might need a little strengthening. The one thing that came up was just the position of women in India in the 50s, that people might not know that. And so that part had to be strengthened just so that people would understand where Meera was coming.
Can I ask a follow-up question related to the previous one? What do you do about context and use of authentic words from text? Do you feel that you need to explain, or I mean, I hate to say the word glossary, but what do you do about context? Based on what you said earlier about making assumptions about your readership, do you feel compelled to explain?
That is a very good question. No, I don't want to explain because I think that, you know, that just makes a book that's not very good when you're adding little glosses and explanations. That just takes away the art of the book. On the other hand, I believe that art should be inclusive, that it should invite people in. I don't believe in writing the kind of thing where, you know, only certain people will be able to appreciate. Yes, in this book particularly, people who know the Mahabharata will appreciate the stories in a different way, because they know the original. They'll be like, oh, she's taken this take over here. But I hope that this will be a compelling story that everyone can really respond to, because I really think that is the nature of great literature. I have read and appreciated books from all over the world. And, you know, I think that's what art is meant to be. Because where's the end of it the other way? Am I going to say that only Bengali people should understand? Because, you know, the rest of India, that's different, right? Only Bengali people from the middle class, from, you know, the kind of background I came from should understand? There's no end to it. I think one has to be artful to create context where necessary. There's a lot of things I write about, not so much in the Palace of Illusions, but in my more contemporary writing, that is very Bengali. The characters are all Bengali. Even my husband, who comes from the south of India, wouldn't be able to understand if the context was not clarified.
Mm-hmm.
No, so I believe in that, and I hope that answered.
Yes, it does. I think my question came from a similar event last week with a Chinese author, where there was a difficulty in translating certain Chinese phrases without destroying the beauty, etc. So I was thinking more in terms of language in addition to context.
Well, yeah, with language, I find that, yeah, like one often has to use some words that
yeah.
are not in English, and you try to write it in such a way that even without knowing the exact meaning, the audience will appreciate what it stands for,
right.
and it won't be something that they're forced to. You know, look, I mean, I have a glossary on the website, and but I don't expect people to really go running to that, because I think they will understand it. And that's what I do when there's a German word or something.
Right.
You know, everyone has to do that
mm-hmm.
if it's an international book.
Thank you.
Right. I'll just add to that, yes, there are lots of Bengali words in my book, and in the Mahabharata, a lot of Sanskrit words. I think
we have time for just one more question, and then the authors will be happy to sign books and will be available here informally till about 2 o'clock. So one more question, if anybody has one, right here, yes.
Yeah, I'm Vinod Basjit. I am the Indian diaspora from Mauritius. So my knowledge of the Mahabharata and the Mayana is kind of shaky. I recall seeing a production of the Mahabharata years ago by Peter Brook, which. Showed one of the Pandavas, I think it's Yudhishthira, disguised as a woman, and I think as a classical dancer. So I was wondering, since we talk about men, women, and very clearly delineated roles, do the epics deal with the issue of gay or non-clearly lay or female roles?
Well, actually, the Mahabharata has two roles that are very interesting. One is the story of Arjun, who for a while in his life becomes a eunuch because of a curse placed on him, and he becomes a classical dancer. So I think that is the one you're thinking of. And the other is Shikhandi, who was a woman in a previous birth, but is now a kind of androgynous character who is used in the battle against Bhishma, and Bhishma won't fight because Bhishma knows the last life, the previous life of Shikhandi, and where he was a woman, and so Bhishma won't fight and is thus, killed, or it leads to his death, ultimately. So I think, yes, definitely there are characters like this.
And I'll add to that just in general, in Hindu mythology, there are many such instances. There's a whole book on that, in fact. I can't remember the title. Two that come to mind is this androgyny of Shiva is often expressed as you find him half woman, half man, and it's the fusion of the two that really makes the deity. And the other one, though, that's similar to what you said, is a nice episode where Vishnu, Shiva has once again, gone off to meditate, and he's needed to keep the world in order. So Vishnu comes to him as a woman, and Shiva really falls in love with him or her. And then, Vishnu manages to lure him back into the cycle of things. So that's a very well-known episode, too.
Well, thank you very much, both Chitra and Manu.
Could I make a quick announcement as people are getting up to do other things? And I wrote this down because usually I don't remember. I wanted to let you know that my new children's book will be coming out at the end of March. It's titled Shadowland, and if you would like to get a sneak preview of the first chapter, you can go to my website, which is www.chitradevakaruni.com. I do hope you will go to the website to find out more about the nonprofits that I'm associated with. Pratham, that works with slum children, and Daya, which works with women who were in domestic violence situations. And also, I am on Facebook, and I invite all of you to my page. Thank you.
And look on YouTube. I've got a bunch of things on that. So, on mathematics and Bollywood dancing.
Manil has a great website, too. I'm stealing ideas from his website.
Thank you all very much for coming.